Today it is October 9th, 1984. We are interviewing Mr. Verma. I am Tammy Lane in History 499.
May I have your full name, please?
L-O-U-I-S, Lewis James, J-A-M-E-S, B-A-U-M-E-R.
Okay. And may I have your address, please?
That's here, 333 D Street.
Phone number?
And is 234. And 3032.
And your year for?
It is October 15th, 1892.
What regiment of the time?
Well, I can't remember. It was a French, but we were...
Right. Okay, I'll just...
French, yeah.
And the decorations, what would you...
That was the... Well, it's simply given, let's talk about it, and then you can figure out what to call it. It was given as a token of, let's say, gratitude for serving with the French.
Right, because
in the French Army. Yeah. As a volunteer. You mean put volunteer with French Army.
Okay.
In ambulance service. And then put down American, you can put down under here with an X here, American Field Service, but that's quite well known.
Okay.
It still exists as a organization which I think finances students from France to come here and from the United States over there. So they've got a lot of money for that.
What was your thanks?
I mean, I was enlisted. Well, I enlisted in the American October 1st. No, what is this? Third Army, Second Section, General Staff. Well, no, that's when I was discharged. I was graduated from Hamilton College and went down to New York. And that was in about May 1917, and then we served with the with the French until the American Army got over there. Mm-hmm. Then when the American Army got over, they took over this whole service.
Uh-huh.
And it was at that time that I enlisted in the Army, but I was already at the front for a number of months before mm-hmm. that happened, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I don't think it'll say here, this is the date of discharge. It was April the 2nd. 19. And the date of enlistment was 1917 in, say, May. May 1917. No, that's not it. It was, August
1917. Where did you serve?
Where did I serve? Well, of course, when after Well, what do you mean? I've served in these areas in France, you see.
In that particular place.
Yeah, and then later I was transferred to the intelligence service, even if you want to put that down.
Okay. What were your approximate dates of overseas service?
Well...
Basically over there the whole time.
Well, sure. From May 1917 to April 1919. Ambulance driver, yeah. And then also intelligence service. After the armistice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was in intelligence before.
Okay. And what was your rank?
Sergeant.
How did you get on with the French, Italian, and Belgian citizens?
Oh, very well, very well. But I tell you one thing might be interesting. When I got into the intelligence service, you see, I was on leave in Paris. In fact, we had to sneak into Paris, which was very difficult and dangerous in a sense, because there were so many people in Paris, they wanted to keep as many out as possible. Mm-hmm. It was overcrowded, so they didn't want all these soldiers to come in, you see, and clutter up the place. So we weren't supposed to go there for leave. We were supposed to go to some place that the Salvation Army had set up, something like that. We didn't think much of that, so we got on the train secretly and jumped off before we got to Paris and snuck in that way. So. And I met a man from my hometown in New York State. He was in intelligence, and I said, for God's sake, get me out of the ambulance service. We didn't want to stay in that because it was non-combatant. You know, in those days, everybody wanted to get up right away and all, get right up at the front line, which was kind of silly in a way. But anyway, that was the sentiment.
Uh-huh.
Today, hell no, I won't go. In those days, let's all get over there and get the job done, see. So he got me into the intelligence service. And I was sent to Le Havre, which is in the seaport town there, where they had a little school for intelligence instructors. And so one of the first jobs I had to get into civilian clothes and to go over to one of the depots where the American soldiers had landed from England after having come from the United States on these big transport ships. When they landed in England, they were shuttled over to France to be ready for combat, you see. And they all hated the English. And the officers wanted to know why was this antipathy against the English people. And so I went over there and I had stripes on, you know, so I'd been in the front and all like that, and they all clustered around me, what was going on. So I asked them, what goes on? Oh, they said, these English, they're just so mad because we should have come in the first place. You see, that's what they thought. Now we come in the last minute and get all the glory. And then they treated us badly on the ships, and they overcharged us, gave us a little piece of pie like that for a dollar and a half or something like that. And that caused a lot of trouble. And, of course, you know, all the boys from different peoples get together, they before they understand each other, you know, the fight. So that was one of the jobs I had there. And then after that, I was sent up with another fellow into Belgium to find out how the sort of underground worked, which helped the American prisoners to escape from Germany and get over to England. And they had, like in the Civil War, they had kind of underground stations where they could move mine and so on. So we went over there, and that was a joke anyway, because it was after, well, it was before the armistice, but anyway, then things had kind of quieted down a little bit in the back anyway. We were there for about a week and then came back, and as I arrived in Paris, the fake armistice was a fake armistice.
Oh.
Well, a few days before, of course, it was in the process, you see.
Uh-huh.
But I suppose some smart journalist leaked it out and said it was all signed. It wasn't signed yet, see. And they had some final little details or dotted this I or so and so on. And then it wasn't really official, wasn't announced until about 3 or 4 days later. So I stopped in Paris just and then heard about this armistice, also heard about the fake, so I didn't wait. The order was going, the hell was going on loose in Paris then. So I went back to my station in Le Havre, and then 3 days later the armistice came along. And I'm sorry I missed the whole deal in Paris, but then we went back to another morning. And well, I had a big party with some of the French people, and French officers, and so on. And there's no homes, no arms, not gee, that was a big deal. And then a few days after the armistice, and so on, I was sent up in civilian clothes with a staff car to the town of Trier, T-R-I-E-R, in Germany, which is a very, very old Roman town. That's by the woman worked on me. And I stayed there and I had an apartment and I worked out as a press correspondent. I go around, people say, well, I'm an American and I'm a soldier, I'm not connected with the I'm a press correspondent, not connected with the Army. And just one room, what do you get from the Army? And I'm a very, very many adventures. And so then they decided that I was to go, because I spoke German very well, and I still do, and make a special trip into Germany, which was forbidden. That was not occupied territory, you see, and then when the peace came by, they stopped, and then there was kind of a non-combatant zone in there, and no American soldiers were supposed to come over here, and no other soldiers were supposed to come over here, and anything like that. But they wanted to get somebody over there to find out how they're getting along, whether they got butter and milk and some meat and what's going on, what other people think and so on. So they picked me to do that and sent me up to Paris. And I went to the headquarters there, and they had to negotiate through Washington to get these special papers from me. Special regular passport, but indicated that I didn't indicate I was a soldier, but just said a civilian. And they had the names of all the countries except the countries we were at war with. So that was my identification. Well, that took 10 days, a couple weeks before that came through. Talk to Wilson all by himself, and then his wife came along and introduced me to her. So.
Was that Wilson?
Yeah.
What kind of conversation?
Well, he was talking to all the boys and so on. So after they kind of left, I stuck around. One of the officers in there, who of course had to keep the president or anybody like that on schedule, was trying to get everybody out, see, trying to get out. And I just wanted to wait till everybody got away. I thought maybe I could, you know, have a little chat. So he stood there pointing at his watch like that, and I wouldn't look at him, see. And so finally I was there alone with Wilson. He's a little guy, I'm surprised.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I said, Your Excellency, I said, it might be interesting for you to know that I just came back from Trier, where I'm stationed, in the intelligence work. And the Germans all look to you as their savior in this thing. You've got to help them get a square deal. That's what they feel. They're all in favor of you helping them get that deal. Well, he said, no, that's fine. But he said, you know, I have to remember that they're the ones that drove Boston going on. And they have to pay a certain penalty for that. There's only so much I can do. And beyond that, I'm helpless. I can do what I can, but they can't escape the responsibility. So I went back to my and then there was a stack of mail that accumulated in the time. And I got that. I used to go in at night in my uniform, because I didn't want anybody to see me anymore, in order not to make to get with the uniform, I could get through the security better to get the headquarters. And I had a trunk locked up with the German secret police, so I could tell them I could do this. But anyway, I got the mail and I came back and I was going to go to dinner. And I write you through the mail and there's some letters this and letters that. And here was a telegram, I don't think it's that one. No, it wouldn't be that one. From my mother saying my older brother had died. And that she had taken steps through the State Department to get me back to the United States as quickly as possible, which I didn't want to do. Because I wanted to sign up with the Red Cross to go into Russia. Mm-hmm. They did a lot of relief work in Russia during the war. And I didn't want to go back to the States anyway, for personal reasons. And anyway, but then in due course, the orders came through and I went to the mustering out station at San Fignon, I think. Yeah. And that was because I enlisted in France and I was entitled to be discharged in France and I wouldn't have to wait for one of the big troop transports right. to come back with all that mess and all things like that. So I went up to Paris and I had to wait a while to get transportation on the ship going over as a civilian. Moving back and forth, it was hard to get reservations. Finally, I got back. And, but anyway, here was an incident. I got into there, and it was raining, and it was always in France at this time. I used to say, if I can ever get back and get up in the morning and put my foot on something that's not damp and soggy, it would be heaven. So we plodded through the rain and all like that. And I didn't have anything to do. So, they gave me in charge of a squad to do some cleanup work or something like that. And I thought, well, it must be an easier way. So I went to the headquarters and said, look, I'm not doing anything worthwhile. I said, haven't you got a job in the office here for me? He said, oh, yeah, come on in. And give me a job in the office. I forget what I did. But I was sitting at a desk there, getting an office or something, and there was a young officer over here that was working with some lists all the time. And finally I said, well, what are you doing there? He says, I got a list here. There's a lot of people lost here. We can't find them. And so I said, well, let me see the list. And there I was on that list. He says, I said, are you looking for this guy? He said, yes. I can't find him. I've been looking for days for him. I said, my God, I'm sitting right next to you. It shows you how, when a big movement like that works, it's hard to keep the paperwork.
Yeah.
So, of course, and in the meantime, I had met, I think, two or three of the boys that were with me in the ambulance service when I was in the ambulance service, so that made it fine. So we all got discharged together and went up to Paris. I had a heck of a time for a couple of weeks waiting for the ship to come back.
Okay.
So that's when I got back, and that's when I got out of the Army.
Uh-huh. What did you think about President Wilson?
Well, of course, we thought he was a good man, an educated man, understanding man. He was a little too idealistic because he didn't realize how those people over there felt, the different nationalities and so on, you see. And they had their own projects, their own fights among themselves about territory and so on and so forth, you see. And he came with his 14 points, among which was, of course, the self-determination of small nations. That was the big deal. See, they'd take over people and just grab them and take them in and make them be a different nationality. You see? And one thing the American people never heard much about, and I got quite interested in it because I had gone to school when I was a boy in Austria for a couple of years in the South Tyrol area, beautiful, beautiful area, and those people there that lived there for a thousand years under different rules and finally with Austria for a long time. The Italians had a pact with the Germans and the Austrians and the Central Powers that agreed that they would all stick together if there was a case of any aggression or war, you see. So when this war came along, the Italians, who had wanted to get this South Tyrol area for a long time, because it took into its territory the Brenner Pass. And the Brenner Pass is the one thing that connects the south of Europe with the central part, you see, going through that tunnel. Now, going over the mountains like that would take days and days. In fact, that's what Hannibal with his army and the elephants came over the mountain, the Alps mountains. But they, in the meantime, drilled that tunnel, you see, and that's the way all the traffic went through. And they wanted to get that because they figured, in case of war, they didn't want to have that available to the northern powers when they stood here and the enemy was right here. Now, if they could move up and take in this tunnel and keep the northern peoples from coming through, why, that would be their salvation. See, of course, the way it worked out with the atomic bomb and all that stuff, that doesn't mean anything anymore. Mm-hmm. But anyway, then they held off joining their compatriots, you might say, in this pact, because they figured maybe the things want to go the other way, and we can get this territory. So they made a secret agreement with the English and the French that after the war was won by the Allies, they would be given permission to take that territory. And they went up, they were fighting in that area in the beginning, you see. And so when Wilson came along and when that was announced, he was quite upset about it, angry about it, because it completely changed his viewpoint of the self-determination of nations, you see. But it was too late, they'd already made this deal. And they couldn't do anything, you see. And nobody knows much about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you talk about today, what goes on today, look what happened to what the Italians did. They came up there, they established factories that had no industrial value up there, just in order to bring a lot of their people, their unemployed people, up there, right, and make a so-called majority population, mm-hmm, which it didn't, but they counted these people in, the citizens, of course, mm-hmm, and everybody else. And they attempted to prove, and a lot of people believed it, that they were a majority up there in population, which they weren't. Well, they made everybody speak Spanish, and Italian. They put all the Italian people in charge of the post office and the army and everything like that. Forbade the teaching of German in the schools, and anybody that objected, the school teacher wanted to teach German in their home. They apprehended them and shipped them way down in the bottom of Italy, in that terribly poor area and all that kind of thing. And so that's it. I got some books out. I have a lot of them, but I only got one left.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting.
Did your opinion of Wilson, when you met him in person and talked to him, did it change at all from what you had thought of him before?
Well, not especially, no. Of course, he was our commander-in-chief, and there was a glamour and all that thing around him and all that business and so on. And of course, he was a great idealist, and he had some good ideas with regard to putting together the United Nations, that,
yeah,
kind of thing, but he couldn't make it stick with the political group, too, and all,
mm-hmm,
that kind of. He was a Democrat, naturally, and that clashed with the Republican thinking and trying to get into office through doing that kind of thing. But, well, he served his purpose then.
Right. Were there any particular
family over there that you were playing with? No, except the American college boy.
Uh-huh.
You see, that American future was made up of college,
right,
boys that volunteered their services, and the college usually donated the funds or donated a Ford ambulance. We had these Ford Model T ambulances.
Yeah.
One of the three pedals, the one in the middle that go backwards, and one on the left, was to shift the gears, and one on the right was a brake, and so on. And we wore wooden shoes there, not when we were on duty especially, but when we were driving the car, because it was always so wet. And with the leather shoes, it would take so long to dry out, and then they'd be stiff and everything. That's why you always have to follow the customs of the natives. they've lived there for years and discovered what's best. Mm-hmm. And these wooden shoes, you know, you'd slip them off and you'd get into something else that was nice and dry, and those shoes would dry in no time at all.
Uh-huh.
The wood would dry much quicker, you see, and wouldn't dry up and twist around and
right.
be hard to get into and that kind of thing.
Huh.
But,
how did you feel about the Germans?
Well, of course, we knew they were our enemies, and so on, and we, of course, had certain antipathy towards them, and so on, and so forth. But I couldn't believe from the beginning all the stories they told about the German people, because I had gone to school over there, and my family were 100% German immigrants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some knowledge of the German people, and so on. The Germans have always been very, very well disciplined and very hard workers, and always were pretty conscious of doing their duty. Going to school over there in Germany, in Austria, the discipline was severe. But in those days, and you know, even at home, we didn't mind the discipline because it was part of the setup.
Right.
Today, it's not part of the setup. The kids today are brutal and disorganized and undisciplined. That's the trouble. Now, you talk about giving money to education. We had the minimum of equipment, but we all learned.
Right.
And in those days, the curriculum in the schools was what are in the grammar schools are what we've got today in the high school.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Yeah, that's true. I think you're right.
And it was the discipline that made it. Now, they could get these kids to study and get them to stop all this nonsense that goes on in undisciplined classrooms and undisciplined in the on the play field and in the quarter schools and all that. I read in the paper the other day, they had to discipline these kids from hanging around making love to each other on the way from one class to the other. It's so absolutely lacking of any sense of discipline that's ruining the country.
Right.
And all you can't do that with money. It takes a conviction.
Right, exactly.
And we are not allowed to have a conviction about anything because that means that you're putting religion into government politics and things like that. Anyway, what goes on?
You were German. Was your father and mother from?
No, my grandfather and grandmother.
Oh, what did your father do?
Well, my father, there's a very interesting story about that. Now, my grandfather came over and he went up to Syracuse, New York. I don't know whether he probably had friends there, but quite a considerable German colony, and he worked for the church. And got a pittance of a salary and so on, had a family, and I think there were five or six or so of the children, and they had a very severe struggle to get along. And he used to come over to the house in the late afternoon and have coffee with them, coffee in the late afternoon, literally 4 or 5 o'clock. And this day he came and was particularly disturbed, and his wife said, "Well, what's wrong with you today?" "Oh, well, this is the same fellow, this fellow, but I never most of it. Wants me to go into business with him." What's it about?" "Well, he's got a candle factory, and he needs some money. He's going fine, but he needs some money to expand and so on." So then time passed, and he came back again, was depressed. "Now what's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter?" Wrote most of it. "Well," he said, "we got to do something, either yes or no." But he said, "What can we do?" Because he has to have time. So she goes in the kitchen and she takes out a crock and dumps the business on the table, and they counted out the pennies and the nickels and the dimes and the quarters and whatever else there was till they came just about $500. And he got into the business and grew very, very rich.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a well-known company. Look it up, the Will and Ball Mechanic Company.
Oh.
So now there's a lesson. If there had been a welfare program, he might have been able to get welfare and that would have killed the whole system.
Right.
you see. Mm-hmm. They had to rely on themselves, and here is this woman. And you talk about women going into business and getting away from their family duties. That woman saved the nickels and dimes out of the little money that she had to run that hospital and take care of his kids. And that made the start of his business. And he went into business, and most people, the trouble with him was he was an alcoholic. And it got so bad, my grandfather bought him out. And from then on, the business went up and down.
So
he had a big branch down in Mexico.
Oh, so your father and I, worked there?
Well, he worked there, yeah. I was in charge of the factory in Montreal for some time, and I helped start a kind of factory out here in Los Angeles. Some kind of a branch of the factory in San Francisco. So I did some work for them. So that was that. But they were both, my mother's family, both the grandfather and the grandfather's family, came from Germany too.
So you had strong ties.
So we had strong ties in that sense.
Uh-huh. How
did
you feel about your officers,
the
NCOs?
Well, we were at the front as a volunteer group of the French Army. We had somebody designated as an officer in charge of us. And he was under a French officer, naturally, because we were attached to the French, and he got his orders from the French, what to do. But there was a lot of quiet, days up there when we were shooting back and forth, but nothing much happened, you see. And our officer was gone all the time, having drinking parties with the French and having a heck of a time right at the front. And we would get official mail after we were taken into the army. We would get official mail saying we had to do squads right in the morning and all like that, and to do this and to do that and do that. We tore it up. The officer wasn't around and he didn't see it, we didn't do it. We didn't
right.
look we took ambulances and went scoured the countryside looking for eggs and for anything we could get like that on the side, which we paid for out of our own money, see. When we were with the French, with this setup, we got 6 cents a day. And at the end of the week, we got a package of tobacco that was, I guess, mostly peanut shells or something like that. And then every day, we got a little supply of wine, which was the scrapings of the barrel, and would cut the ending, the lining of your throat if you drank it. But the French, of course, were accustomed to it, and they went for it very, very strong. So we didn't think much of him. I think he was discharged or something. Or he was put into a minor rank. Just made out of trouble. That was that. But outside of that, that's the only experience I had. Because I didn't do any, wasn't with any combat. What we did, when the English army was being driven back and defeated, the French army was sent up to replace them, and we went up with that army. But then we got to a place where the fighting was very, very severe, and we all had to retreat then. And as a matter of fact, one of the other fellows and myself went up, and the traffic officer at a certain place misread the signals or something, and he let us get through, and we went right toward the fighting. And when we got to this little town, it was being shelled all over the place, and we saw the ambulance people and the hospital people coming out of buildings and rushing and getting into trucks and going back. So we turned around and went back and almost got caught in it. Well, we worked for 3 days, a day and night, evacuating the wounded soldiers that came in from this fighting. And the tragedy was that most of the nearby hospitals were filled up. So when we got there, you see, when you got to the first aid station, they'd check them. And they'd write and say what the condition was and what ought to be done. And all they did was look at that, and when they saw that they needed severe attention, they'd say, well, we can't handle it here, now you better go there. We'd go there, and then they'd say, you got to go there. And a number of times when I got to where they were supposed to be taken care of, they were all dead. Because they couldn't survive. And that one, it was a terrible situation. Well, after that, then, of course, I was transferred to the intelligence and went up to Germany. That was it.
As a fighting soldier, was your attitude towards the home front changed?
The only thing was they naturally kept away from us all the number of deaths that happened over here in the flu, you see. In fact, I lost two brothers. One was in the Navy and the one that, that died in New York 3 months after that. I didn't hear about it sometime. The mail was just going getting to me. They were dying over here so much, and my younger brother, who was in the Navy then, died in the hospital in Brooklyn, and when my folks who were up in California were rushed back to be there, they couldn't find the body. There were so many people and so many soldiers dying with this flu ladder all the way. They couldn't keep track of them. Well, it was an Asian type flu. I don't know if it was an epidemic that struck the country. They didn't want to demoralize the troops by the knowledge, you know, how things were going back home. That was
what did you feel about your father?
Well,
he was a
what father?
Not San Diego, the priest.
Well, we didn't have anybody like that.
Oh, you didn't?
No, because we were a small group. There was probably a French here. Well, there was a Frenchman that served at that, but of course he didn't come to contact with us.
Did you have a strong religious
family? Oh, yeah.
And they didn't change at all?
No. Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
Right.
Christ is Christ, right after he changed.
Mm-hmm.
No, our family, of course, Catholic from way back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a set of conviction.
The thing.
Yeah, sure.
You held your belief even though you saw death and destruction.
Well, I know, but that has nothing to do with it. The death and destruction come from the wickedness of man.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with the nature and the fundamental principles of any faith,
right.
Especially the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were fighting to save our civilization from destruction. By a malignant power like the Nazis in Germany. That was an evil, evil thing. We had to fight it off.
Right.
Just the way today we have to fight off the Russians. And that's why all this nonsense about the freeze, atomic bomb and things like that is wrong, because we have to do whatever is necessary in order to keep the Russians from taking us over. And they say in their books and in their whole system that we're going to have to conquer the world if we have to do it by lying or stealing or killing or whatnot. And that's what they're doing. They're coming, they've established a base in Cuba. We're trying to establish a base in we say, Grenada. And we kept them out of that, unfortunately. We're trying to keep them coming into San Salvador and Nicaragua. And then people say we shouldn't go in those poor little countries and tell them what to do. We're not telling them what to do. We're keeping the Russians out. That's the whole point of that. So, I mean to say, with the death and destruction, that was part of the price we had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
See? And part of the price you have to pay for anything. If you want to get thin and you're fat, you got to quit eating.
Mm-hmm.
You see? If you want to quit smoking, you got to go through the process of changing your system from a dependency on nicotine to one that doesn't require that, and that's hard. That's difficult.
What were your feelings to the industrial workers back home?
Oh, we didn't bother about that.
Okay. What about conscientious?
Well, from a personal standpoint, I think most of it is just simply a cop out. Because anybody could go up and say, well, gee, I don't want to go to war, and so take the route. Yeah, we should investigate and find out how much conscientious objection they've done before they started with conscientious objection about going to war.
Mm-hmm.
And after all, we've got a freedom over here. And it's a precious thing. We've got to fight for it. And if you think that you can preserve that freedom without fighting, you're just on the wrong track, because those people are very serious. Look at the agreements that the Russians have, we shouldn't say Russians, we should say communists, it's not the Russian people. The communists have broken almost every time that they've signed a treaty. Look at this chemical warfare. They signed an agreement that they would not make chemical warfare, and we signed it, and we didn't do it, and they did it, and they're doing it in Afghanistan. Now we find ourselves obligated to save ourselves to counteract with the chemical program in order to tell them, look, if you're going to try this, we're going to do it. And they won't try it, but they know we've got that in our arsenal, which is a terrible thing. But it's nothing but facing up to reality. That's the point.
What did you and your comrades talk about for the most part?
Oh, what we're going to do on leaving and about back home and all that kind of stuff.
What was your typical leave?
I only had about two leaves when I was in the service before I got into the intelligence service, and those were both in Paris. Mm-hmm. And of course, we wined and dined and went to the theaters and that. And the horrors of war didn't bother as much as that. Of course, one thing, there was always, and you'll find it always in any situation like that, such a contrast. Now, out at the front, the French soldiers that kept the record, they measure our gasoline every time we did anything. And they've checked up the number of mileage and the number of liters of gas they put in. You see, there were about 20 of us Americans, and then there were a bunch of Frenchmen that did all the work. See, all we did was drive the animals up to the pump, pick up the wounded, and bring them back, and so on. And when there were no wounded, we stayed out there two, 3 days in the trenches. But here they figured that gasoline so carefully. But when they got them back to Paris, here were these great big staff guys with these women, these whacks. No, what were they? Not the women's auxiliaries. Or they just had some other word for the English girls that drove the staff cars, you see. They would sit out in front of the cafes while the officers were in having a party with their engine running, using up the gas. And here at the front, where we were rescuing wounded men and so on, they kept track of every doggone drop that you used, which of course had to be done too, but then yeah. Those things don't bother you. That goes on, see. I remember one time at college when we first got into the war, it was in April, you see, that we got into the war, but it wasn't until later on that the American soldiers got over there, of course. We had an officer of the Canadian Army down to come to college to get us acquainted with squads right and squads left, and we had wooden rifles and stuff like that, the drills. So we were out on the drill field there, and it began to rain, cats and dogs, and we stood there and all like that. And the officer yelled for us to lie down in firing position, and we all stood there. Well, you're gonna flop down in the rain and in the mud and the dirt? And he screamed and yelled at him. He says, "I told you, gave you the order." So of course we didn't. But then another time, he said, "I want to tell you something. When you get at the front, and you're at the front fighting, and they're shooting and everything, and people are dropping around and everything like that," he said, "don't lose your cool." He said, "That's normal. That's the way battles are fought. It's normal for all that confusion. You've got to keep your head, think what you got to do and what you got to do next," which is the thing, you see. Because it's pandemonium. You can't expect to fight a battle and have everybody sitting in a chair and say, "Well, now we're going to fight here, we're going to shoot here," and so on, and then make it count.
Did you think that the Americans were prepared to fight?
Oh, I didn't really thought of that. Yeah. We thought we were fucking sure we were prepared all the time.
Do you think that, who did you think was the best fighting unit in each country?
Well, I had no opinion on that because I wasn't acquainted with the fighting qualities of other people. We, of course, always thought we were best. naturally, but as a matter of reality, you'd have to really witness some fighting here or there, or read some accurate description of the fighting of other countries. You see.
What did you think about the discipline?
The discipline in the army? Yeah. Well, we didn't have any, because that was an exception. I wrote the whole thing up one time and destroyed it. Oh, I destroyed so many things like that. I destroyed that permit, that passport I got, special visa and all that. And then, of course, I was in Munich when the war broke out in 1914.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What did you feel being American there?
I was on a trip with another young fellow, and we got on a ship in New York on the spur of the moment. Landed in Holland and went over to England. We got a little hotel there and stayed there for two or three months. We got permission, which any American could get from the embassy, reading cards to the British Museum Library. And I remember reading several books on history and all that. Finally, we met some boys, college boys that had been on the continent that had bicycle all over, so we thought we'd better do that, so we bought some bicycles and made a trip, round trip through the bottom, the lower part of England, and then over to France, to Paris, and in Paris we decided, well, maybe we'd stay the next year and go to school over here. But before doing that, we wanted to take a trip through Germany and around up and back to Paris. So it was then, when we got to Munich, the next day the war broke out, and it didn't move. Because all the troops, the trains were used as the troops. You know. Mm-hmm. And, we had the time. Gosh, it was big celebrations every night. And beer gardens, you know. And of course, the Germans in those days were going through everything from one town after the other, you know. And then when the communique would come in, that they had taken another town, of course, then the screaming and yelling and the snake dance out around the streets and everything like that, there was a great deal. So I was there for